www.thebeyondbeyond.org.
And we return to this today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. Today we chat with prolific author Stephen Johnson and discuss his latest book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. He joins us from Belvedere, California. Welcome to you, Stephen Johnson. Thanks for coming on our program.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So give us the info, the thumbnail on pure progressive as opposed, say, to traditional liberal and conservative slants that people may have.
Yeah, well, it's this idea that has been kind of growing in my head over the last 10 years, mostly inspired by people around me who were working on interesting projects that I thought were really admirable. And I realized that they all shared this kind of core value, which is they believed in the power of what I call in the book a peer network, a kind of decentralized group without traditional leaders, often with a lot of kind of diverse perspectives, coming together to collaborate on solving a problem, often without traditional economic rewards, and kind of an open network of collaboration. And that meant, and I'll give you some examples of how this works, but it what was interesting about these networks is that they didn't look like a traditional top-down kind of government agency, and they didn't look like a traditional corporation. They weren't in the private sector, but they weren't, a kind of a government state agency at the same time. And so when you thought about, you know, the kind of traditional way we think about the left and the right, where the left is a big champion of, you know, kind of the role of the state and government, and the right, you know, kind of believes in the libertarian values of unleashing the market wherever we can, these people didn't really fit either of those categories. So I wanted to give them a name so that we could see them as kind of a unified movement and have a kind of a shorthand description. And so they believed in the power of these peer networks, and they believed in progress, you know, and they came out of something of a progressive tradition. So I decided to start calling them peer progressives.
And the relationship with peer progressives and the internet, is that the main basis that makes them coalesce?
Yeah, it's kind of a subtle point. I in this book, I've tried very hard to not just fall into the trap of being a techno-utopian who thinks that, you know, if we can just get the world on the internet or get everybody on Facebook, then all of our problems will go away, because that's not the case. You know, technology sometimes can help us solve problems we have in society, but sometimes it's all about face-to-face encounters and people getting together and talking and forming these networks in the real world, not using software. But the internet is very important to this story because the internet was built and the web was built, and a number of the things that are now great success stories on the web, like Wikipedia, were built using this form of organization of the peer network. So they involve these kind of open collaboration between lots of different people working in different organizations and different institutions, in some cases funded by the government. The early days of the internet, the early research was funded by the government, so it's not as if government doesn't have a role to play here. But the important thing about the internet and about the web and about a lot of the technologies that we use in all of our kind of devices and daily lives today is that these things were built collectively and collaboratively. Nobody owns the internet. Nobody owns the web. And that is part of their power and part of their great kind of creative energy, is that these are open systems where other people can kind of improve on them and build on them. And, you know, if you and I were having this conversation 40 years ago and I told you that there was going to be this new form of collaboration where people without ownership and private property were going to build interesting new things, you would have said, well, that sounds great. You know, I'm sure on your commune, you're going to make some beautiful baskets. but you wouldn't have taken it very seriously, and you would have said, well, look, you know, the truth is, if we want to build something big that transforms the world, you know, you need either a big government or you need a big corporation. You can't just do it through this kind of utopian collective labor. But that is exactly how the internet was built. That is exactly how the web was built. And now we can point to that success and say, well, if peer networks were able to build these technologies, what else can they build? And that's where the book kind of takes off. It's not that the internet is the solution to the problem. The internet is a role model for us, that we can kind of emulate the way that people came together to build the internet. We can use that as a model for our attempts to solve other kinds of problems.
What kind of foibles are those who adhere to the pure progressive label that you've created subject to?
Well, I think sometimes we do fall into that techno-utopian trap, because so many of the people that I talk about in the book have come out of the tech sector in one way or another. And that's partially because, you know, they've seen the success of these models in the technology space. And in truth, you know, technology is one part of our life today where people remain generally pretty optimistic and feel like progress is still happening. And so there's kind of a bias towards, you know, technological solutions. And again, that's why I tried to spend a lot of the book pointing to some of the face-to-face solutions that are out there. But I think all of us, you know, have a tendency to be a little bit too excited about technology.
We're speaking with author Stephen Johnson. We're discussing his latest book. It's called Future Perfect: The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. And he's joining us from California. Stephen, how about some of the historical examples of pure progressive nature before there was an internet, going back to a small, I think the example like in Genoa or something like that?
Well, there are lots of, if you look at the early trading towns, really, in you know, kind of the early days around the Renaissance, the early trading towns, Genoa and Venice and so on, where in some sense where kind of modern capitalism was born, they had really strong kind of peer network-like architectures in the sense that there weren't big corporations, they didn't have, you know, big bureaucracies, there weren't big large states controlling them. They were really these cities made up of these kind of traders and merchants and small guilds. And they were very kind of adaptable and flexible and innovative in all these ways. And, you know, that structure is still a very powerful one. And what's happened since then is we developed these mass institutions, whether it was a giant multinational corporation, which is incredibly top-heavy, and it's got a, you know, executive branch that controls all the decisions and all the and ends up capturing a lot of the wealth. Or you have these giant state institutions where, you know, you have a huge federal bureaucracy with a, you know, huge amount of power concentrated in the hands of a small number of people. And those kind of early trading towns, I think, are a great example of that much kind of flatter, less hierarchical structure, and a reminder that those kinds of systems can you know, be a great engine of progress.
Tell me, Stephen, about one of the big points in your book is that you say our current media doesn't give enough credit to incremental progress. Some examples.
Yeah, I the book starts with this kind of extended preface about the state of progress. One of the things we have in this society, and it, in truth, I think it comes from us as well as from the media. I mean, it comes from human beings and the way that we process information and news, as well as the media just kind of takes that and amplifies that. And the problem is that we are basically biased against stories of slow incremental progress. We love to hear dramatic breakthroughs when the new iPhone comes out, when there's some sparkling new great gadget, or when something catastrophic happens. We gravitate towards that news. But you know, the story about something that is 2% better than it was last year, as it has been, you know, for the last 20 years, that's the least interesting news story you've ever seen. You know, this one part of society is slightly better than it was the year before. People just don't seem interested in that story. And so, you know, in the book I talk about aviation safety, for instance. It's a classic example. Aviation safety actually has been getting, you know, progressing even faster than that. It is now staggeringly safe to fly in a commercial airplane. You are more likely to be elected president of the United States in your lifetime than you are to die in a commercial airplane crash. But, of course, we don't really hear those stories because, you know, the news of no airplanes crashed today is not a headline anybody wants to run. And so we only hear about the plane crashes, as rare as they are. And so people have a skewed sense of how safe it is to fly. And in the book, there's a whole long kind of almost social studies quiz where I, you know, ask the reader what they think the trend lines have been over the last 20 years for about 10 or 15 different kind of key metrics of social health. And it's everything from, you know, kind of violent crime and sexual assault to air pollution, to divorce rates, to drug use, to volunteerism, to participation in the electoral college, I mean, in the electoral process, to graduation rates and dropout rates. And every single one of these kind of facets of society, the trend is significantly positive over the last 20 years. I mean, in some cases, you know, when you look at crime, you know, it's amazing how much progress we've made.
Even including divorce?
Even including divorce, yeah. Divorce, that's a great example. People say casually all the time, people, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. That's just something people always throw out. And that hasn't been the case since the late 80s. In fact, divorce rates have gone down by 30% since they peaked at the end of the 1980s. And no one ever hears this, right? You know, it's not something that people report. And so we have this, the problem is that it sets up this, you know, twofold problem. One is we have a skewed sense of how we're doing as a society. And we also then misinterpret the forces that kind of lead to that progress, because almost all of those things did not come from the private sector. They didn't come from corporations. We didn't see, you know, the tremendous decline in teen smoking that we've seen. That wasn't corporations that did that. In fact, a bunch of corporations tried to keep teenagers smoking as much as they could. But it was a different thing. It was, you know, thousands of people, sometimes government-sponsored, you know, kind of public sector advertising. Sometimes it was, you know, word of mouth and peer networks and, you know, families and doctors and regulators and all these different forces coming together that create this positive trend in society. And the problem is that we don't, it's hard to celebrate that, because it's hard to celebrate something where the force behind the success story is not a single person or a single hero. You know, with aviation safety, the reason why the planes are so safe is not one single breakthrough. It's, you know, thousands of little changes that, you know, tens of thousands of people have put into place over the years, tinkering with the way the airplanes are built, tinkering with the way the air traffic control system works, and so on. And, you know, it's a lot easier to, you know, put, you know, the hero pilot of the Miracle on the Hudson, Captain Sully, on the cover of Time magazine than it is to put 1,000 engineers on the cover of Time magazine. And so we don't tell this story of kind of mass collaboration that is such an important story, and we miss out when we don't celebrate that kind of collaboration.
Again, we're speaking with author Stephen Johnson about his book, Future Perfect. Stephen, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. St. Thomas University presents a solo show of renowned Miami architect Robert Suodrow at the university's Sardinus Gallery October 11th. The art exhibit is launched at an open-to-the-public reception to meet the artist from 5 to 7 p.m. Additional information at 305-2628-6663. St. Thomas University offering a master's in art management designed to teach the business of art.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper with you. We're rejoined by prolific author Stephen Johnson about his latest book, Future Perfect. Stephen, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your many books?
Oh, yeah. My kind of blog where I update with all these various things, is it Stephen Berlin Johnson, Stephen with a V in Berlin, like the city in Germany, which is my middle name. And I'm Stephen B. Johnson on Twitter, at Stephen B. Johnson on Twitter.
How about the failure of larger institutions in today's climate? I'm thinking the semi-demise of newspapers and that more nimble entities seem to be able to prosper better. Touch on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. What we're seeing in media is the shift from these very large kind of top-down news organizations. There are a small number of them that had a disproportionate effect over the information we received each day. And those large organizations are kind of breaking up, getting smaller themselves. Some of them are going away, although most of them are staying. They're just smaller. And they're being kind of surrounded by, much more kind of diverse array of news, kind of individual journalists and small organizations. So it's everything from kind of full-time bloggers to, for instance, academics who are specialists in certain fields who used to only communicate with other academics, basically, in their scholarly publications. Now there's a whole category of kind of academic blogging where, you know, this is a wonderful thing in the economic crisis, where all these economists who, you know, basically had all these interesting things to say about the state of the economy as we were going through that crisis, who were now able to kind of use the blogging platform to get their voices out, whereas they, in the past, they would have, you know, occasionally had a guest, you know, editorial in a mainstream newspaper, and they would have been able to say a few things, but mostly they would have just been kind of silent. And here they suddenly had this venue to talk, and all these interesting kind of nonprofit, smaller news organizations that have arisen in recent years. So it's a time of great experimentation. And on the one hand, if you look at it purely in terms of the old institutions, you know, if you look at it, for instance, in terms of just the number of reporters and editors on the payroll of big national or big city papers, then it looks like decline. It looks like these institutions are failing, and you know, thus the news is bad. But if you actually think about the information that's out there that is circulating now, thanks to all these technologies and thanks to all these new different platforms, particularly if you look at politics and technology, the spaces where we've had the most time for this new system to kind of evolve, because that's one of the first things that people started talking about when the internet came along, there is no question in my mind that there is more information, more diverse sources of information, more timely information than we had 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, I talk about the first big presidential campaign that I really immersed myself in, which was the 92 campaign of Clinton versus the first Bush, which I was just in grad school at that point. And, you know, when I followed, I tried to read everything I could about that campaign, which meant reading, you know, the Times and the Journal and listening to NPR and watching CNN and reading the New Yorker and the New Republic and, you know, a couple of other magazines. But nowadays, you know, when we follow these campaigns today, we've got all those institutions are still there, and they're all generating, you know, as much information as they were before. But there's so many other voices that are part of this process, and really in-depth statistical analyses of what's going on. You know, bloggers like Andrew Sullivan, who gather all this information from all around the web, that are able to kind of curate a really interesting series of views. Direct access to the candidates' speeches themselves that you can go and see on YouTube in a way that you never would have been able to do before. There's no question there's far more information there. Now, it's noisier, and there are more crazy people, you know, than there were before, because we've opened it up to a broader kind of selection of the population. But, you know, to see that story as a story of decline, you know, even though some of the newspapers are, you know, not as profitable as they once were and have had to lay off some people, I don't see it as a decline story. I see it as another instance of progress.
Well, what about trust and veracity, though, in these smaller news operations and bloggers? And on this program a couple of times, I put information that I gleaned from Wikipedia and was burned by it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big part of this, and it's an important question. There have been a number of studies. Wikipedia is a great example. There have been a number of studies of Wikipedia which have compared it very rigorously to the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is, you know, the kind of gold standard for expertise. And what they have found is that there is almost no difference between Wikipedia and the Britannica in terms of accuracy, in the sense that there are mistakes in both. It's not that either is perfect, but the Britannica has a bunch of mistakes and Wikipedia has a bunch of mistakes, but the mistakes are rare. For the most part, they're both very accurate, very comprehensive. The differences between Wikipedia and the Britannica are, one, Wikipedia has far more information than the Britannica does. Average entries are much longer, and Wikipedia covers far more topics than Britannica does. And when there is an error, it is corrected much more quickly on Wikipedia.
Right.
So the Internet, while it is true there are errors out there, there are also, you know, there's better fact-checking, in a sense, on the Internet. And so the facts are, when errors do surface, they tend to be corrected much more quickly. So, you know, you have to learn, you learn kind of networks of trust, right? You learn, you learn if you follow a blogger, you have to, you know, kind of spend some time with him or her and see what other people are saying about them and see how they respond to criticism. And so it's not like we can kind of just naively dip into the Internet and trust everything we see. And that's something we have to be teaching, for sure. We have to be teaching kids, you know, that kind of network digital age literacy. I think on the whole, expanding the number of voices that are part of the media conversation is worth the trade-off and the sacrifice of a little bit of accuracy. And it's the same argument that people make with democracy, right? I mean, when you allow ordinary people to vote on their leaders, you absolutely introduce a number, you know, a whole number of people who are insane or who are ideological or are trying to distort the system for their own private interests, who were suddenly given the right to vote that weren't allowed to vote before. But we've decided as a society that democracy in the long run is a better system for getting the best results out of our leaders. And I think the same is going to prove to be true with media.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Stephen Johnson about his book, Future Perfect. Our telephone number, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, and also email, that's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Stephen, touch on the what you refer to as the pothole paradox, that news judgment is defined many times by proximity. My daughter's scraped knee is actually probably more important to me than hearing about another Middle East suicide bombing attack.
Well, this is, you know, one of the overarching points of the book, whether it's about politics or about media, is that the peer network approach to solving problems is already working extremely well and is kind of the most exciting, I think, on the local level, in local communities and local neighborhoods, in some cases because of technology, in some cases because of just people figuring out ways to collaborate without technology. In terms of media, what I call the pothole paradox is this: when you've got a giant pothole on your street, and it's been driving you crazy for the last 3 months, and you're constantly scraping your car on it, and it's, you know, collecting water, and it's just an ugly eyesore, and that pothole finally gets filled by the city, that's actually, you know, in a crazy way, that's news in your world, right? You're like, hey, that was good news. The pothole is filled, yay. But the paradox of it is, if you live just one street away from that pothole being filled, that news is the most boring thing you could possibly imagine. Like, you would never want a newspaper that began with a headline, you know, pothole on 16th Street is filled by the city, right? That's just not interesting to 99.9% of the people in the city. And so that's always been the kind of problem with local news, is that the big events that matter to you or things that are very close to you, but those events don't kind of scale up to the kind of attention of an entire city. And so, you know, when the deli opens around the corner from your house, that's big news, but you don't want to have that on the front of the city paper as well. But nowadays, because media can be so targeted, and because we have now all these wonderful local bloggers who are writing about neighborhoods and communities, and because we have new channels of kind of sharing news with our neighbors and so on, we can actually kind of focus in on those local events and cover them and report on them and identify the problems or celebrate the solutions. There's a wonderful organization that I'm kind of part of, which is called Patch, which is part of AOL, that's trying to do kind of neighborhood reporting all around the country, that is able to kind of focus on those hyper-locals, we sometimes call them, issues. And I think that's one of these places where clearly the news is getting better, right? And, you know, you can debate whether our coverage of national events, and particularly our coverage of international events, has improved. I think clearly in terms of national political news, we have better reporting than we did before. But there is no doubt in my mind that we have better local reporting, because we're able to cover kind of block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, in a way that a big city paper never could.
It seems, though, there's much less serious investigative reporting by newspapers. It's one of the most costly and time-consuming attempts at writing that's possible. But it seems like investigative reporting has kind of been on the slide.
You know, it's a very interesting question, and I think it's still too early to tell. There was a wonderful piece that the technology kind of scholar Clay Shirky did a number of years ago, where he went and he looked at a bunch of kind of mid-market city papers that were generally considered to be good papers that had a tradition of great investigative reporting, that were kind of looking at what was going on in City Hall and investigating abuses of power and so on. And he went through these papers at their heyday, right? You know, right at the peak of, you know, the local advertising market, you know, in the kind of early 90s or whatever it was. And he physically went through the papers and he literally cut out the articles that were written in that mode, the kind of classic local beat reporter writing original investigative pieces for the big city paper or the mid-market paper. And then he actually physically weighed the articles that were in that mode versus the rest of the paper. And it turned out that in all these papers he looked at, you know, the actual investigative pieces were, you know, just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the paper. And the paper was, in fact, mostly made up of, you know, recycled AP and Reuters stories, you know, stock market tables, sports scores, and, you know, local gossip and things like that. And, in fact, in almost all the cases, it was one or two reporters at each paper that were entirely in charge of the investigations. It wasn't like there was a whole team. It was just one or two that were doing all the important stories. And his point was, when you look at it this way, you know, yes, it may be true that those kinds of reporters are going to kind of need a new home. On the other hand, the information that's now available to them, thanks to open government initiatives all around the country, their ability to kind of do the research and detective work that they used to have to do, it is much, much easier to do that now, thanks to the internet, thanks to everything that's available online, and thanks to their audiences, which can help them research and kind of crowdsource the stories they're working on. But even if that weren't true, what Clay Shirky was trying to say is, you know, the way we should be thinking about it is not trying to save an entire industry of newspapers. It's just trying to figure out where to put those two guys or gals and find an institutional home that where they can do their work. And if we can just figure out a way to keep, you know, those two or three investigative journalists per town in some kind of institution, and maybe it's a newspaper or maybe it's some other kind of organization, then we'll at least be doing as well as we were before, and maybe we can actually figure out a way to support five of those people, given, you know, given our interest in having them working. So it's not like we can't solve this problem if it indeed becomes a problem, and it may well be. I think it's too early to tell. You know, the other big problem we've had is that the newspaper realignment has happened. The technology has cut into the kind of profit margins of these newspapers at exactly the point that we went through the, you know, biggest economic crisis since the Depression. And so it's been hard to tell how much the newspapers have been challenged by long-term trends in technology, which is clearly part of the story. But it was also the kind of short-term trends of the economic collapse, which, you know, when we start to come out of that, as we are starting to do, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the bottom line of a lot of these papers.
We're speaking with Stephen Johnson. We're talking about his book, Future Perfect. We're going to take another short break and be back with more.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and HD1 Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and the Palm Beaches, 91.5 WKWM. We are funded by listeners like you and by Nacional Funeral Homes, offering funeral, burial, cremation, and exportation services. The death of a loved one is a time of grief and loss. Nacional Funeral Home finds a way to help everyone. Information at 305-910-4169. Nobody likes sitting in traffic, but you can help Miami-Dade County do something about it. Blocking an intersection causes major gridlock. It's not only frustrating, it's illegal, and you could get fined. So do your part to keep traffic moving. Keep intersections clear. Don't block the box. Details at miamidade.gov/MOVN.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. We're joined by Stephen Johnson. His latest book is called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Stephen, I have an emailer here. He or she asked, are worker-owned companies an example of peer progressive networks?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm glad they brought that up. Yeah, I talk about them in the book a bit. There's a whole chapter on basically the internal organization of corporations, because this is one of these interesting things where, you know, if you believe in these kind of decentralized systems, you know, markets are a great example of decentralized systems, right? There's nobody kind of planning the overall economy or the overall market. And so markets can be a great force for these kinds of values. The problem is that corporations themselves are very top-down. And in most of their forms, they have very strong kind of leadership structures, and they have been increasingly top-down in terms of the way that they share the kind of the wealth that they create. And we've got this kind of runaway wealth inequality problem in this country. You know, many corporations, the kind of ratio of the highest-paid employee to the lowest-paid is something like 400-to-1 now. And so in the book, I talk about a lot of different organizations, corporate organizations that have deliberately chosen to, in a sense, kind of flatten their hierarchies. And some of them are employee-owned businesses, where the shareholders are the employees. And others are just companies where they may have outside shareholders, but they've deliberately decided to allow the kind of rank-and-file employees to have more control over the fate of the firm, to make more decisions and have more kind of autonomy, and to share the wealth more equitably inside the company. And so these, you know, companies like Whole Foods, that has this ratio in terms of you know, kind of high to low income ratio inside the company, is something like 19-to-1 instead of 400-to-1. And a lot of the tech companies that have been so successful over the last 30, 40 years in Silicon Valley and elsewhere have always had this property. They've always had very strong stock option plans where the employees participate much more in the overall success of the company. And what we've found, and there have been a number of studies that have convincingly shown this, is that not only is that, you know, a good thing to do in terms of, you know, treating your employees well and giving them more stake in what they're doing, but it actually is better business strategy, and that the companies that have these structures have greatly outperformed their more traditional kind of competitors on the S&P 500 over the last 10 or 15 years. So making the corporation itself more of a peer network is something that I think it's important for the private sector to do.
Tell me, Stephen Johnson, in your book you talk about that modern protest movements have changed quite a bit. Say I go back to Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, or Abby Hoffman or Tom Hayden, but the protest movements don't have discernible leaders today. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, think about Occupy Wall Street. Who was the face of Occupy Wall Street?
I can't think of it.
There wasn't one. And quite deliberately so. These movements are not about, you know, having these kind of figureheads. They're about the network. And in fact, Occupy is a very interesting example because, Occupy began as, you know, what we call a hashtag on Twitter. Where there's a little hash symbol, and then it would say Occupy Wall Street as a way of, which is what we use on Twitter to kind of organize tweets. So you say hashtag Super Bowl or hashtag presidential debate so that you can see all the tweets about that event. And, for several months, that's all Occupy was. It was a little hashtag Occupy Wall Street, and people liked that, kind of the sound of that, and it circulated through the social networks and started to pick up kind of steam. And it was only after a couple of months that people said, hey, why don't we actually occupy Wall Street? Let's go down and put our bodies in this square in downtown Manhattan and then in, you know, downtown areas all around the country and around the world. It was both a peer network in the sense that it didn't have traditional leaders, and it literally started with the social network of Twitter. And that's how it kind of built up momentum. So it's a great case study in how these things can affect kind of protest in this time.
What about its future? What are your views?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I tried to point out in the book is that, you know, I think there's been a very valid critique of Occupy, which is that it was a wonderful kind of awareness tool in that it pointed to the problem of wealth inequality in very powerful ways, and it introduced this lexicon of the 1% and the 99% in very powerful ways. And that, in some sense, was what it was designed to do, it seems like. But it didn't offer, you know, a roadmap of change. It didn't engage with the political process. It didn't get people elected the way, for instance, the Tea Party did. And I think that is caused some people to say, oh, well, this is the problem with, you know, leaderless systems and network protests, is that they don't get anything done. They're just good at, you know, kind of complaining about things. And so that's why in the book I go out of my way to point out that almost all the systems I'm talking about in the book do not suffer from that problem. They are truly systems that are about building things, about improving life, about actually making things happen. I talk about Kickstarter, the arts funding service that allows ordinary people to fund artists who are working on interesting projects. And, you know, again, it's this peer network approach to this. And Kickstarter is now on track to distribute more money to artists than the entire budget of the National Endowment for the Arts. And it's only 3 or 4 years old. So Kickstarter is not a platform for expressing outrage at the woeful state of arts funding. It's a platform that actually gets money into the hands of artists so that they can make the work they want to make. And I think that's what I tried to showcase in this book, not just the protest movements.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with Stephen Johnson, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email is open. That's radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Stephen Johnson, could you distinguish between peer progressives as opposed to, say, traditional libertarian views?
Well, one of the things I try to do is to take seriously that libertarian critique of central planning. The libertarian argument that comes from the Austrian economist Hayek, among other people, is that decentralized systems like markets generally outperform and out-innovate centrally planned systems, planned economies, because the the economy and the world or the city or whatever institution you're talking about, it's too big and too complicated, and it's too many kind of dimensions to it to understand, to kind of condense it down so that 10 planners in a room somewhere can figure out what the strategy should be. And so what markets do is they divide up all that knowledge, and no individual person in a marketplace needs to understand everything. They just need to understand their little sector of it, whether they're buying or selling, creating something or consuming something. And I take that very seriously, and I think that's a core insight for peer progressives as I've described them. But the point that the twist on that is that peer progressives don't believe that markets can solve all of our problems, and that there are whole facets of society where the market is either indifferent or it creates its own problems, like, for instance, the kind of wealth inequality problem that we have. And so we need other institutions to kind of step in and fill in the holes, sometimes called the market failures. And what peer progressives say is, let's build equally decentralized systems, equally collaborative systems, to solve those problems that the market can't solve on its own. So it's not about bringing, big government in to solve these problems. It's bringing in kind of peer networks to solve these problems. And it's not that governments are going to go away either. It's just that we have an additional tool here that we can use, a different way and approach to solving these problems that that we're only starting to experiment with. And there's still a lot to learn, I think.
Touch on something that kind of struck me in the book, as you said that Al-Qaeda is actually a peer progressive movement. It's one of the reasons it's so difficult for the West to battle them, because it's not like they're just battling a crooked dictator somewhere.
Right. I guess I would make a slight caveat. I would describe them as a peer network, but not peer progressive. That
okay.
may sound like it's splitting
All
hairs,
right.
hairs, but they were using that in the sense that they had a leader in some traditional sense, but they were not a big state. And they were much more of a decentralized network with bases all around the world, kind of communicating in this much kind of more decentralized way. And they weren't peer progressive in the sense that they didn't have progressive values. In fact, you might call them peer reactionary.
Right.
Maybe that's the way to describe it. But they were, using that kind of decentralized structure, and that made it very hard to kind of attack them. It was much easier to deal with a big traditional state where there was, Saddam Hussein, who was in charge of a country, and you could say, okay, this is the leadership right here. They've got a big capital. They're centrally located. Let's go attack them. But when you're fighting a network instead of a state, it means that you have to fight a very different kind of war. And I think we spent, almost a decade trying to figure out how to do that, which we weren't kind of optimized in terms of the military to kind of fight a war against a network rather than a state. So I brought it up just as a reminder that it's not that, networks are intrinsically good. You can use, just as you can use the internet to spread, malicious ideas, you can use the network architecture, the network structure to, wage a very regressive terrorist, war for very bad reasons. It's that the network architecture is effective, and it can be abused by people who have, kind of malicious or malevolent intent. But fortunately, I think most of us don't, and so we can use these tools for good, not for evil.
Tell me, could you touch on developing brand loyalties in a peer progressive atmosphere? How has that changed from traditional brand loyalties?
Yeah, well, in the study that I referred to earlier about the companies that had more kind of peer network structures, and in some cases were employee-owned businesses that we were talking about, what this very interesting study did is they looked at a lot of these companies, and it turned out that they had a huge amount of brand loyalty, but they didn't actually spend that much money on advertising. And it was companies like Whole Foods, for instance, where people just kind of love Whole Foods, but there actually weren't that many ads running for Whole Foods, and or it was Southwest Airlines. People love Southwest, but compared to their competitors, they weren't spending as much money kind of building the brand. And the argument was that because the employees the kind of rank and file of these companies were much more involved in the overall success of the company, both in terms of compensation and the decision making. You know, they were the employees really felt that they were helping to build a company. They weren't just kind of working for the man and taking home this crummy paycheck. That enthusiasm from the employees was carrying over into their customers, and people who were using the service or using the product or going to the stores or flying the planes, those customers, you know, felt like they were part of the process too. They were part of this kind of extended family of the company, and so they developed this great brand loyalty, even though these companies weren't actually spending money promoting their brands or as much money promoting their brands. So again, it's this argument that you create that kind of peer network structure inside your organization, even if it's a for-profit organization, and in the long run, it'll be, you know, kind of better business for the bottom line.
Well, I'm sure that social media has changed quite a bit the way companies handle their customer relations. If you really screw somebody over, it can go viral and really do a lot of damage to your company.
Yeah, I think that companies have to figure out, this is the whole idea of kind of conversational marketing, where they have to figure out a way to, instead of, you know, having this kind of brand message that is top down, and it's like, here's our official statement about why our company is so good. Instead, they're in this kind of permanent dialogue with their customers, and that dialogue is happening in public. Other people are watching them talk to their customers. And the companies that have figured out the right kind of tone for that and have really tried to engage with their customers, JetBlue has done a really good job with that over the years. You know, that's a very powerful marketing strategy. It's not really marketing anymore because it's so two-way. You know, it's not just here's our message. We're putting it out there. It's like, well, we're trying to listen as much as we're trying to actually communicate what the brand means.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Stephen Johnson, but I'd like you to touch on how you say that the 311 call centers that are so popular are a peer network.
Well, this is a great example of the power of local and all of this that I talked about a little bit before. So in 311, in any of these cities that have it around the country, I don't know if it's in Miami, but...
Yes, we do.
Yeah, so you can call in and you can report problems and you can request services and... say there's a pothole on my street, or I want to know if the schools are closed today, or the bar down the street is making too much noise. And the city uses all that information to kind of keep track of the shifting needs and observations of all the people who live in the city. And so they've created, instead of hiring a bunch of experts on the city payroll to go around and, you know, identify all the potholes, they've reached out to this network of ordinary neighbors, just peers. Anyone who can dial three numbers on a phone can help them identify all these problems. And it makes the city more adaptive and resilient and inventive in meeting the needs of its citizens. And it widens the kind of the scope of participation so that ordinary folks who have otherwise, you know, their only relation to the government is they every now and then they vote, are suddenly actually helping their government and giving feedback and Even though they're doing it kind of selfishly because they're just answering, you know, asking for services. So it's a great success story, and it's one of my favorite examples of how peer networks can really change the way that communities work.
Well, in a thumbnail, could you relate the story about New York City and this mysterious aroma of maple syrup that was wafting around?
Yeah, I actually experienced this firsthand. This bizarre thing started happening where whole neighborhoods on the west side of Manhattan would start to smell like maple syrup every couple of months. And it was totally baffling to everyone. People would call into 311 and say, hey, it smells like pancakes. What's going on? And people were worried that it was some kind of chemical attack or something like that. And so they finally, after years of this, they finally realized that they had all this data. And they knew where people were calling from, and they knew what days they called. And so they looked at all the data, and they looked at the weather patterns for each day and the wind position, basically, for each day. And it ended up looking at all that data, pointed back to this very specific spot in New Jersey across the river, and they went to that spot, and it turned out there was an industrial plant that was doing kind of flavor and taste processing, and they every now and then would manufacture artificial maple syrup. And so they figured out that that's where the smell was coming from. And it was just a beautiful example of how a system like that, you know, they did not design it with that intent. Nobody said, we want to build 311 so that it can detect maple syrup scents. And, you know, it was not part of the plan. But because it was open, because a large number of people could contribute to it. It was able to solve that problem in a really kind of magical way.
Stephen Johnson, thank you very much. His book is Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Very interesting hour, Stephen. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. You can find author and book links, including today's, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. We also have free audio archives and MP3 downloads. That's at our website, WLRN.org. And tomorrow's program begins with NPR host Michelle Martin. She'll host her Tell Me More program from our studios on Wednesday. Also, poet, actor, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez and his book, Man Up, Cracking the Code of Modern Manhood. And to the calendar, on this day in 1871, 141 years ago, the Great Chicago Fire erupts and burns for 2 days. The business of Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over a lantern is a myth. And on this day, 1965, 47 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson has gallbladder surgery. Showing much class, he's the first president to show a scar on television. One more while we consider our one love. On this day in 1980, 32 years ago, reggae giant Bob Marley collapses on stage in Pittsburgh in what proved to be his final performance. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor and died in Miami 7 months later at Jackson. And we leave with this thought from Lyndon Johnson, whose third heart attack killed him in 1973. Quote from LBJ, "I once told Nixon that the presidency is like being a jackass caught in a hailstorm. You just got to stand there and take it." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're listening to